United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Chessman presiding before court number 19-00192. Invenergies Renewables, LLC et al. Versus United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Amanda Berman. I'll be presenting this morning on behalf of Invenergy Renewables, as well as Clearway Energy Group and AES Distributed Energy. With me on the line from Cole & Mooring are John Brew, Larry Eisenstadt, and Katie Quinn.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Matt Knightley here with Hughes, Hubbard & Reed on behalf of the Solar Energy Industries Association, or SEIA. With me today is Dan Wichnowski.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Kevin O'Brien at Baker & McKenzie for EDF Renewables, and with me is Christine Stretfield from Baker & McKenzie. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Stephen Sassini from the United States Department of Justice, and I represent the United States, and with me is Will Martin from the Office of the United States Trade Representative.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is John Grover at Fox. I'm here with my colleagues Diana Quiet and Rita Gorgons. We represent Hanwha Qcells USA and Oxen Solar.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning. This is Judge Kasman. Welcoming you all to this argument this morning. We will be addressing a number of matters in this argument. The prime issue is the motion to dissolve the preliminary injunction that was filed by the government. We will also be touching upon other matters, including the motion to supplement the complaint as filed by the plaintiffs and plaintiffs' interveners. The parties, of course, have received these questions that were submitted by the court and have filed responses. These are the questions of May 8, 2020, and the parties have filed their detailed responses, which are much appreciated. This argument, as you know, is intended really to provide an opportunity for the parties to respond to the answers that were submitted by the counsel to the questions that were posed on May 8, 2020. By way of housekeeping, as you know, each side has been allotted 50 minutes, and I understand. Hello? Yes, I understand that defendant that Mr. Giacchini will be taking 30 minutes, and that Mr. Gurley will be taking 20. Am I correct in that?
That's correct, Your Honor. Speak to
the team. Yes, Your Honor. One or two of my colleagues also might speak up during this oral argument.
Okay, as long as you're within the 20 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not exceeding the 20 minutes that you've agreed to. That's fine. And with respect to the plaintiff and plaintiff interveners, I understand that the plaintiff Invenergy will be speaking for 30 minutes. Is that correct, Ms. Berman?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And with respect to SEIA, I understand that Mr. Knight will be speaking for 20 minutes. Is that correct?
That's right, Your Honor. If Ms. Berman goes a little short, I'll use up her time.
That's fine. Also by way of ground rules, I leave it up to the parties as to whether they would like to begin their remarks with an opening statement, but we will be proceeding in series. So the defendant will go first, can make whatever opening statements that they want, and then it takes the 30 minutes. Then defendant intervener will go next. If you want to make an opening statement, you can. Both parties, if they want, can, within their time allotment, make a closing statement. Totally up to you. And similarly, with respect to the plaintiff, if you and plaintiff intervener, if you want to make opening statements within your time allotment, you can. But you're not required to make those statements. And each of you within your time allotment can make closing remarks. So without further ado, I think we will begin with the government, Mr. Cassini, since you have filed the motion to dissolve the preliminary injunction.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The only issue remaining with respect to our motion to dissolve the PI is whether USTR possesses authority to withdraw a previously granted exclusion that is found to undermine the objectives of the safeguard measure on solar products. And the answer here is clearly yes. And I want to answer the court's question first, before I dive into the plaintiff's answers to the court's questions in the letter. And where exactly does that authority come from? Well, first, under the statute, Section 203A of the Trade Act, the president has authority to, among other things, take any other action which the president considers appropriate and feasible, and also combinations of all of the other enumerated actions within Section 203A. So in the proclamation where the president imposed the safeguard measure at paragraph 4, he delegated three things to USTR. First, he delegated the authority to promulgate exclusion procedures. And second, the president delegated authority to make exclusion determinations. And third, the president delegated authority to implement those determinations. And those are all found in paragraph 4 in Proclamation 9693. So under this authority that was delegated by the president, USTR issued procedures in February of 2018. And those procedures can be found at 83 FR 6670. And under that presidential authority that was delegated to the USTR, USTR explained that it will, quote, grant only those exclusions that do not undermine the objectives of the safeguard measure. Well, ultimately, in the April withdrawal, USTR reconsidered an earlier exclusion based on its own inherent authority to reconsider previous decisions. And in this case, the facts and circumstances show that the exclusion was, quote, undermining the objectives of the safeguard measure. This authority clearly exists with the USTR. TKS is the Federal Circuit case that is binding on this court and which provides that an agency is always free to reconsider previous determinations, especially one such as this that ultimately circumstances showed was undermining the objectives of the safeguard measure. And USTR made some very specific findings in that determination. USTR concluded that by disincentivizing domestic producers' production of bifacial solar panels, interfering with their ability to increase sales of monofacial and bifacial products in the utility segment, and having a depressive effect on prices for monofacial solar panels, the bifacial exclusion is hindering the domestic industry's adjustment to import competition. And therefore, the USTR determined that the bifacial exclusion did not meet the criteria for a legitimate exclusion. It should be withdrawn. Now, this determination didn't stand alone. As USCR noted in the April withdrawal, the ITC also agreed with its separate determination. And, in fact, a unanimous ITC found in the March report that we cited in our response to the questions that the exclusion for imports of bifacial modules is likely to have significant effects on prices and trade in both modules and cells. The ITC also concluded that lower-priced bifacial modules will likely drive down U.S. market prices for modules. And ITC also determined that bifacial modules are likely to account for a growing share of the market over the next few years and can substitute for monofacial products in all market segments. And that the exclusion has, quote, put significant price pressure on U.S. module producers. These can be found at pages ES3, Roman numeral 3-4, and Roman numeral 3-2 of the ITC's March report. In sum, the only determination of the court that was underpinning the preliminary injunction is no longer at issue. Alleged procedural harm no longer exists. USTR followed notice and comment procedure and issued a detailed explanation of why it was withdrawing the exclusion on bifacial panels. USTR had this authority. It had been delegated from the president under the president's own Section 203A authority and under the Federal Circuit's binding precedent in TKS. USTR possessed the authority to reconsider its previous determination.
Can I ask you a question? In the answer to the questions, the court's questions that were submitted on Monday, there are attachments. There's a memo, Solar Section 201 bifacial panel exclusion. Is that part of the record of this case? I mean, I guess there is no administrative record that's yet been put together. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's no administrative record that's yet been put together. We provided this in order to respond to plaintiff's contention that the FR notice lacked any depth. And we wanted to assure the court that USTR conducted a detailed and thorough analysis of all of the evidence that was placed before it. And the court's own rules, Rule 73.3, envision exactly that there would be some sort of published determination and other analyses that go into it that are part of the record. In that regard, we filed these particular memoranda in order to address those criticisms. If and when the United States ultimately does file an administrative record and is challenged to, and I just wanted to add one more thing, was that the Garris memo was responsive to the court's questions, obviously, because the court did ask about the USTR's analysis. And if and when we do file an administrative record in this case or in some other case, the Garris memo and the memorandum that was initialed by the United States Trade Representative will both be part of the administrative record, as will the comments and all of the materials that are identified in Rule 73.3.
Thank you. And before you get into to dissolve the TI, just want to ask you quickly about the motion by the plaintiffs and plaintiffs interveners to file a supplemental complaint, the government and the defendant intervener have both responded that that's a question that's within the discretion of the court. If that a motion were allowed to file a supplemental complaint, which would embrace the more recent circumstances and issues surrounding the April withdrawal. What effect would that have on your pending motions to dismiss? One was that you have a motion to dismiss for failure to join an indispensable party, and then a broader motion to dismiss.
I think the broader motion to dismiss is moot, would likely be rendered moot, because the April determination, the April withdrawal, clearly renders moot the October withdrawal. And the most analogous case would be this court's decision in Natural Resources Defense Council, in which the court issued an opinion about 3 weeks ago regarding a very similar case where an agency was subject to an injunction but using separate authority issued a new determination that supplanted the remedy that was provided in the previous injunction, and we asked the court to dismiss the case as moot, and the court analyzed its jurisdiction as it should and determined that the case was moot.
Thank you.
Going down the questions one by one, with respect to question number one, we take issue with how plaintiffs characterize the question. USCR is not seeking to modify or reimpose the October withdrawal, and we filed a motion asking to vacate it. And in fact, if that were the case, we would have made the withdrawal effective November 2019, not May of 2020. Also, the case that plaintiffs cite, Concilio de Salud, is really an apposite because the court dissolved an injunction without addressing a clear error in the earlier determination that was carried through into the later determination. The only error that the court found with USPR's October withdrawal, at least with respect to the PI, was that it failed to follow the procedures set forth under the APA by not providing notice and comment to the parties, as well as possibly not an explanation. To the extent that those were legal errors, those are clearly cured by the April withdrawal. Regarding question two, the fact that the PI remains in effect does not prevent a finding that it's moot. I mean, once again, the harm that plaintiffs alleged from the safeguard, from the October withdrawal, which was a procedural harm, is no longer presented. And importantly, the April withdrawal does not rely in any way on the October withdrawal. It was an entirely new discrete proceeding under USPR's inherent authority to reconsider previous determinations. With respect to question 2B, the April withdrawal is entitled to the same treatment as any new action by the government. It's presumptively correct. And as we had made clear before, any harm stemming from the April withdrawal is reparable because in the event of a finding against the government, importers would recover any deposits of duties unlawfully collected. Argument regarding business uncertainty is also no longer valid. Plaintiffs did not have a realistic expectation when the court granted the PI in December that, first of all, that the government would never be able to collect duties on any entries. If the government were to prevail and ultimately the October withdrawal were sustained, the government would be able to go back and collect duties from importers. Second, any harm from the April withdrawal is reparable because duties will be refunded if...
That might be here, yes.
So I understand that there was a mechanical issue with respect to AT&T's operation, and we are all back online, and understand that Mr. Gohl offered counsel the opportunity to start over again, but that counsel has have opted to just to resume, and there will be some effort to splice the tape or put things together, and I think that we'll just do the best we can with respect to the recording. And so Mr. Cassini, would you like to resume now?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. May it please the court, just to recap before the interruption, I opened with a description of the how the President's authority under Section 203A was delegated to USTR in Proclamation 96-93. This authority included authority to promulgate exclusion procedures and to make exclusion determinations and then to implement those determinations. The USTR issued procedures in 2018, which did exactly that, and USTR made very clear that he will grant only those exclusions that do not undermine the objectives of the safeguard measure. And he also provided criteria in those procedures that he would look to in order to make that determination. Ultimately, in the April withdrawal, USTR determined that that the bifacial panel exclusion would undermine the objectives of the safeguard measure, and provided an explanation why. There's a much more detailed explanation in the Garish memo. And later, the ICC unanimously agreed with USTR's analysis in its memorandum. So now we are at question 3B. Although, should the court, we believe the court has the discretion to assert jurisdiction over the motions to supplement the claims, and only then will the court have jurisdiction over challenges to the merits of the April withdrawal under the APA. At this point, that issue is not before the court. The April withdrawal is presumptively correct. The only issue is really what's akin to jurisdictional facts on our 60B motion as to whether the April withdrawal complied with the APA as discussed in the court's injunction opinion. Turning to question four, plaintiffs confuse the merits of the April withdrawal with the procedure leading to the April withdrawal. Those are separate issues. It's the latter, the procedures leading to the April withdrawal on which our motion to dissolve the PI relies. The substance of the claims against the April withdrawal are not currently before the court, and that determination is presumptively correct. And absent of finding that that particular determination is somehow erroneous on the merits, the court cannot enjoin its application. For A, there's a similar confusion in plaintiff's claim, and the maintenance of an injunction with regard to the October withdrawal is very different than the entitlement to an injunction with regard to the April withdrawal. They're separate questions. Claims regarding the merits of the April withdrawal are not yet before the court. And plaintiffs need to provide an actual justification based on the record for why there's a likelihood of success on the merits with respect to the April withdrawal. The only legal issue relating to the April withdrawal is the authority, which the court issued the question to the parties about. Question four. The court does have authority to clarify, but that does not mean that the authority to clarify could bar the implementation of the April withdrawal without some sort of finding regarding the April withdrawal, likelihood of success on the merits of a plaintiff. And also another analysis of, at the very least, the public interest and the balance of the hardships in light of USTR's findings and the ITC's findings. With respect to question five, the only claims currently before the court are claims relating to the original complaint. So plaintiffs claim that somehow you can transpose their procedural complaints about the October withdrawal to the April notice simply does not make any sense. I'll move forward to question nine. The answer is that the court can resolve challenges to USTR's authority in the first instance of this proceeding. We provided the chain of authority from Section 203A all the way to the April withdrawal. And that is really the only issue that needs to be examined before the court can withdraw the preliminary injunction. Question 10. The court can't rule on whether the April withdrawal was arbitrary and capricious because there's no administrative record for the court to base its determination. But what the court can do is look at the procedures that were followed by looking at the January procedures, looking at the April withdrawal, and looking at the decision documents, which include the Garrish memo, the Lighthizer initials memo, and the FR notice. And based on those authorities alone, there's no basis to conclude that plaintiffs have suffered any procedural harm with respect to the April withdrawal or that there's any sort of APA violation under the April withdrawal that would merit an injunction at this time. With respect to paragraph 11, plaintiffs could have asked the court to remand the court under the ordinary course, under Supreme Court opinion. That is the ordinary action that a court would take. But we see no need to really go down that road here because the procedural harm alleged by the plaintiffs has been dealt with by the April withdrawal, and there's no basis to continue the injunction. Thank you. You have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Cassini. Mr. Gurley?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to start out with a short introduction, and then I'll proceed to answer the court's question, and then add additional commentary on what Mr. Cassini said without trying to replicate it.
Thank you.
Again, good morning. This is John Gurley for Q-Cells USA and Austin Solar. As you know, we are profoundly and directly implicated by the PI and the pending decision on the listing of the PI. You know from the background of the case, the Section 201 release was necessitated by the fact that 280 CBD cases against China had not worked. Section 201 relief imposed by the President was designed to give the U.S. solar industry the relief it needed to grow and adjust from competition and imports. Q-Cells USA itself relied upon the Section 201 relief in making a decision to build a $200 million facility employing 700 people in Georgia. Were the preliminary injunction to stay in place, it would be contrary to law, contrary to the public interest, and extremely injurious to Q-Cells USA and other domestic manufacturers. Record evidence in the PI stage of this case shows the huge amount of orders Invenergy, EDF, Clearway, and others have already made. These are just three companies. Bifacial solar panels are interchangeable with monofacial products and can serve all U.S. markets. All of our arguments have been borne out by the ITC's midterm report, the ITC March 2020 report, the April withdrawal, and the Garrett memo provided yesterday by defendants. On the other hand, the arguments of plaintiffs are directly contradicted by these same sources, including the independent ITC. Of course, we realize the basis for the PI was procedural, the fact that the U.S. did not follow the APA. But they've effectively abandoned the October withdrawal, coupled with the April withdrawal, as right as any wrongs that plaintiffs might have suffered. There is abundant reason to dissolve the PI. The USTR has clearly taken notice of the language in your PI. That is why, consistent with the language in your PI ruling, they initiated notice and comment for the potential withdrawal of the bifacial exclusion. This court, in its PI opinion, stated as follows. Repealing the rule, therefore, also requires rulemaking subject to APA comments, notice and comments. The USTR has done exactly that. The January notice issued by USTR was exceedingly transparent, and multiple parties filed comments on the record, including plaintiffs. The April withdrawal, from a procedural and subsidy point of view, meets all the requirements of the APA. The USTR has also unequivocally stated that the April withdrawal supersedes the October withdrawal. That in itself should be enough reason for the court to dissolve the PI. If there is no October withdrawal, the PI has been rendered moot. Out of an abundance of caution, because there may be some confusion with CPP, and defendants have requested you to formally rule that the PI is no longer warranted. They've asked it to be vacated. Plaintiffs' attacks on the dissolution are not legally sound. The April requirement did meet requirements of the APA outlined in your opinion by setting up a mechanism for notice and comments. While complaining about the tight schedule, plaintiffs alone held over 1,000 pages of comments. Plaintiffs were hardly prejudiced by the schedule set forth in the January notice. The April withdrawal is not arbitrary and capricious. The USTR sufficiently explained the facts on which it relied and the reasoning of its decision in the April withdrawal, such that the decision was not arbitrary and capricious. We provided a response to the issue in question 9 of our responses to your questions. USTR has provided a clearly intelligible and indeed compelling rationale for its decision. The bifacial exclusion cannot be maintained because it will undermine the safeguard measures objectives by resulting in significantly increased imports that would in turn compete with domestic CFPB products in the United States. The Garrett memo goes into great detail to explain the rationale for USTR's decision. But with all due respect, we believe that the scope of review under the arbitrary and capricious standard is narrow, and a court is not to substitute its own judgment for that of an agency. We do not believe it is appropriate for the court to evaluate whether it agrees with the logic in the Garrett memo. Rather, it is sufficient that the USTR has issued an FR notice summarizing that logic for issuing an April withdrawal, and that there was an underlying analysis. That makes the April withdrawal presumptively legal. The April withdrawal complies with all procedural requirements of the APA, the type of deficiency the court found in the October withdrawal, and which served as the basis for the PI. This, coupled with the abandonment of the October withdrawal, clearly constitutes adequate change circumstances to warrant the dissolution of the PI. The April withdrawal is a separate and distinct agency action, based on a separate notice and comment period and decision-making process. If plaintiffs seek a PI to enjoin the government from taking steps with regard to the April withdrawal, the burden of proof lies with the plaintiffs to establish they are entitled to the rare protection of a PI based on a government action relating to the April withdrawal. If the court grants plaintiffs notice to file a supplemental complaint, they will have their right to file for another PI. But that is for another day. The USTR has gone through all the proper steps outlined in your preliminary injunction, Your Honor, in your opinion. There's a federal register notice. There's a Garrett memo. There's notice and comments. They acknowledge the arguments of all the parties. What more can the government do? The government has unequivocally stated that the April withdrawal supersedes the October withdrawal. They've said the magic words. They've done everything by the book, and more importantly, follow the rulings made in your preliminary injunction. Now I will focus on rebutting some of the arguments proffered by plaintiffs and the responses to the questions and the questions posed to the court.
Thank you.
The question asked was essentially whether the USTR has the power and authority to withdraw an exclusion. That's the essential nature of it. I won't repeat Mr. Sissini's arguments, but I completely agree with them. The Garish Memorandum set out in great detail the inherent authority of the USTR and the fact that it flowed directly from their authority to grant, to make procedures for exclusion, to make exclusion terminations, and to implement those terminations.
What is your best precedent to that proposition?
Well, there's inherent authority that the federal agencies have the power to really consider their final determinations, and that is Elkin Metals versus the United States. There's a series of cases we cited in our response to the questions which talk about courts always agree that agencies can redetermine their determinations as long as they have a legitimate reason to do so.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
There's also 19 U.S.C. 2171 broadly sets forth the USTR's general authority to act on behalf of the president. And I think it's important to remember that if an exclusion request were obtained by fraud or mistaken information or whether anything times have changed, it is our understanding that the exclusion request of Bifacial was portrayed as the next product. But as you've seen from the information from the USTR and from the ITC reports, there is multiple gigawatts of capacity around the world. So it would be completely against logic to not allow the USTR, who has the authority to grant an exclusion based on the fact that it was not supposed to hurt the U.S. industry, once there's information on the record that says it will hurt the U.S. industry, to withdraw that exclusion. You quibbled with the manner in which they did it in October, and was it a quibble, you issued a preliminary injunction. And USTR has listened carefully, we understand the logic of what you did, and they've taken every conceivable step to adhere with the ruling and to the concerns that you have. And I think the information on the record now provides you with ample information to dissolve the PI. Now I'll go down just to a few points to supplement what Mr. Cassini said. And I'll just point out some of the bigger issues raised by plaintiffs and which I think are still an issue in this case. First off, I think it's been established that the preliminary injunction should be dissolved because of changed circumstances. While we understand that the burden is to show that there have been changed circumstances, the government has met that burden. They have won, said they're going to effectively abandon the October withdrawal. They've asked you to vacate that withdrawal. Secondly, they've gone through the April withdrawal purposes. It's hard to imagine more compelling changed circumstances than abandonment of the original rule and introduction of a new rule which complies with the rulings that you made in your preliminary injunction. Let's remember that the April withdrawal is a separate and distinct agency action based on a separate notice and comment period and decision-making process. And because of that, there's no ability for, I think, the plaintiffs to say that somehow the current injunction still applies to that agency action. One of the issues raised by this court and addressed somewhat by the plaintiff is that they should wait, the court should wait until the end until it's heard all the arguments and ruled on all the subsidies counts in the motion, including probably the new supplemented complaints to lift the injunction. Well, that's just not right, Your Honor. I think Mr. Pacini gave you the case, which is effectively on point, that it's not necessary to do that. Here, the very basis for the preliminary injunction was the flaws in the October withdrawal. But now that the October withdrawal has effectively been withdrawn, then there's no reason to keep the preliminary injunction in place. This case will go on for months and months and months.
And I think this court understands that there is a limited amount of time left for the Section 201 relief. Plaintiffs themselves said that if they're allowed to supplement the complaint, there will be a new administrative record. There will be answers by defendants and defendant intervenor. There will be three sets of briefs, four arguments, and probably supplemental briefings. And even in an expedited way, that will be months and months and months. We've already gone through 11 months of a period where we believe that plaintiffs have received an undue reward because of the bifacial exclusion. There's no need to assess merits. I'm sorry, Ron, do you have a question?
No.
There's no need to assess the merits of the April withdrawal before dissolving the PI. Again, these are two separate entirely agency actions. There's plenty of time for the parties to brief and review and look at the administrative record of the April withdrawal. The only likely defects the court identified in the October withdrawal were procedural in nature, and they've been resolved. Plaintiffs make a rather remarkable argument that the existing PI can be extended to cover the April withdrawal, but the very language of the preliminary injunction where the court said the withdrawal was specifically limited to the withdrawal in October of last year. And it would be, I think, legally impermissible to extend that injunction to cover a new withdrawal based on new facts and a new administrative record. Preliminary injunction relief as to the April withdrawal is a separate issue that need not be determined to dissolve the PI. As you know, Your Honor, preliminary injunctive relief is an extraordinary remedy never awarded as of right. To obtain relief again, the plaintiffs would have to go through the four different prompts, and we believe they will fail on each one. But if they want to go down that route, they certainly have that opportunity. Plaintiffs argue that the government can somehow be better taken care of the other three prongs of the injunction. But as you know, Your Honor, the balance of interest, irreparable harm, and public interest all flowed from the fact that there's a procedural defect. And the procedural defect was USCR's failure to abide by the Administrative Procedures Act. And once that has been remedied, then all the remaining prongs fall. And even if they don't, they've been waived, which is kind of an odd argument. The fact that likelihood of winning on the merits is clearly not going to be in the favor of plaintiffs means that the preliminary injunction should be dissolved. Just give me a second, I'm trying not to repeat stuff that Mr. Fifteen said.
Sure.
They complain again that they didn't have adequate enough time to file comments. As they noted in my introduction, they filed over 1,000 pages of comments. And there's no APA requirement that they get 30 days here, 30 days there. The only APA requirement is that after there's a rulemaking, that the public is given 30 days notice. And this is effectively what the government has put in the April withdrawal. Plaintiffs continue to argue that the April withdrawal was arbitrary and capricious. And I think plaintiffs expect that there's a different law for them than from anybody else in the United States. There was a separate Federal Register notice which outlined 9 basic points which supported the USCR decision to make the withdrawal. They also provided the Garrett memo, which is 18 pages of detailed arguments going through the parties' positions. I think it's helpful for this court to understand the context in which these exclusion requests are being made. There have been hundreds of exclusion requests, I think, made in solar alone. A USCR is grappling with thousands of 301 exclusion requests. The Department of Commerce, I think, is in the tens of thousands of 232 exclusion requests. If you listen to plaintiff, they would think that every exclusion request would have a five-page Federal Register notice with an attachment of detailed decision memo. If you can imagine the size of the Federal Register and imagine the magnitude of the effort required by the government to do this. I'm not saying that they don't have to have a basis for their decision, but we're in an odd period where we have so many exclusion processes flowing through the government. And when you look at what USTR did in this case for the high case exclusion, I think it's pretty remarkable. And on its face, the USTR took into account everybody's arguments, provided a detailed memorandum, not only supporting its decisions that it's made, but also describing the basis for their lawful authority to do so. As you know, Your Honor, the USTR received 15 comments and 49 subsequent comments. That's 54. They've done a lot of work. And they've supplied the information that allows this court, just from looking at the four corners of the document, to determine that they've abided by the APA. The USTR has provided a reason for a change in policy, and they've done it in a robust way through the Garrett Memorandum and the Federal Register Notice. They've provided a statement of basis and purpose for why they are changing their decision with respect to the bifacial exclusion. One of the big issues brought up by plaintiffs was that they had failed to address the issues of substitutability raised in their comments. Well, as you know, USTR did that in the Garrett Memorandum, and it certainly touched on it directly in the Federal Register Notice itself. So, as the elephant in the room, as you know, Your Honor, is that when plaintiffs filed a response to your question yesterday, they failed to mention the Garrett Memorandum. I think we're all waiting with bated breath to find out why they did that. But if they think the Garrett Memorandum is insufficient, then they can bring up that point in their supplemental complaint, or if they add a supplemental complaint, they can bring up in the briefing stage going forward. But it's clear that the USTR did its job. It's also clear, Your Honor, that the USTR is allowed to look outside just of the comments received from the various parties. We cited several cases which confirm that it is encouraged, in fact, for government agencies to look at new information, to use their own resources and their own expertise. The USTR is not a potted plant. These guys have been working solar issues for years. And to think that they don't have their own resources, they don't have their own ability to look at public information and to look at ITC reports, which has specifically been sent to USTR, is a rather ludicrous position. I don't have anything to add on the issue of remand other than say a remand is based upon a particular record. And the record for the October withdrawal is one record, and there will be a separate record for the April withdrawal. So I think they're trying to add confusion to the court analysis by saying that there should have been a remand in the first instance. The October exclusion has been withdrawn, and now there's a new exclusion, a new withdrawal out there that will have its own administrative record. If you don't have any questions, Your Honor, I just have a short summary in closing, but I want to wait to see if you have any questions.
I don't have any questions at this point.
Okay.
You have 5 minutes.
Okay. There you go. I think I'm going to take three. Your Honor, I'm hoping third time is the charm of this oral argument. I think all of us are somewhat fatigued with this case. It's a good kind of fatigue. Your Honor has made us all dig deep into the law. All the lawyers, I think, are doing a good job. At the end of the day, we're acting in one which is required by law, and that is to dissolve the preliminary injunction. Plaintiffs are clearly trying to delay this as much as humanly possible. You're likely going to allow them to supplement the complaint. After confirmation of the administrative record, there will be three briefs, an oral argument, and supplemental questions. This is going to take months and months. In the meantime, Section 201 relief inexorably starts to wind down. Each month, He said, I will repeat to you the economic harm to defendant interveners, as I think you understand this issue very well. But now we have the new invisible enemy, which is COVID-19. This is putting even more strain on the domestic producers than before. Combining declining demand, a loophole the size of Montana, and an army of very hungry importers getting a 20% discount, Qcell and other U.S. solar module manufacturers will have a hard time surviving. Your plan manufacturing order was very clear. You said if you're going to have an exclusion through a notice and comment period, then you must have a withdrawal using a notice and comment period. The government has followed your instructions to the T. But this new April withdrawal is a new case. I'll admit some little murky that the government is placing the April withdrawal on the record, and I'm also saying at the same time it's a new case. But the government is operating in good faith, and we agree with that approach. They're trying to be transparent. They all know that the injunction you have put in place is rather broad, and they're seeking your benediction on the procedures you put in place, and I think that's smart. Otherwise, there might be some ambiguity that you left out. Your Honor, I feel like every time I stand up before you, I go from advocacy to almost begging for the relief that hand law, OPSCON, and domestic industry are seeking. But being a lawyer, again, I'm getting used to it. And, by the way, my role as a husband is effectively the same thing. We ask you to lift the injunction. It's the right thing to do. Plaintiffs will have their day in court. If they win on the merits sometime in the future, they'll be able to get their money back. But in the meantime, let the administrative process play out like it's supposed to. In the meantime, let the domestic industry receive the Section 201 relief that the ICC, USTR, and the President thought was so important. Thank you, Your Honor, for your time and attention.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gurley. I just have one question in response to your observation that the plaintiffs, should they prevail in the future, would be able to get their money back. What do you say to the downstream entities here who say that they can never get their money back?
Well, the downstream entities should have contracts put in place with the importers of record such that if there is a refund, they should receive it. That's a commercial issue best solved by the commercial entity.
Thank you, Mr. Gurley. We can now move to the plaintiffs. Ms. Berman?
Yes, good afternoon, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Just wanted to check.
And I'm pleased to say that we have not reached the afternoon yet. It's still 11:35.
Sorry, you're right. It feels like
it may seem like the afternoon.
All right, well, I'll try to finish before the afternoon. I am going to start with just a brief opening statement here. There are three core and interrelated reasons why we think the court has to deny the motion to dissolve and continue to enjoin USTR from entering into force, making effective, or taking any action that reflects or includes withdrawal of the bifacial panel exclusion until this court decides on the merits once and for all whether that withdrawal is lawful. The first reason, these are not arguments, these are facts, Your Honor, things that I think everybody agrees on here. And the first is that the government concedes that the existing PI prevents any withdrawal of the exclusion from going into effect, including its April notice. It conceded that again in its recent responses to the court's questions. For example, in response 7, it said, we view the court's injunction broadly as enjoining USTR from directing CCD to collect Section 201 duties on bifacial panels excluded from those duties as a result of the exclusion process. It said a very similar thing in response to question 3. So at least plaintiffs and the government are in agreement that the existing PI does cover the April notice. Second, the premise of the government's motion to dissolve is demonstrably false as a matter of fact. The government says over and over in its responses to the court's questions, and I heard it say it again here today, that the sole basis for the PI was the court's conclusion that USTR had failed to fulfill APA notice and comment requirements. You know, it said that, for example, at the response four, the court based the likelihood of success in its preliminary injunction solely on its conclusion that the October withdrawal was not issued pursuant to notice and comment procedure. But, Your Honor, as I think the court knows, those statements are simply incorrect, as is evident from a very quick review of the TI opinion, and specifically at pages 44 to 46, where the court, in fact, found not only that claims were likely to succeed because of a lack of notice and comment, but also because the withdrawal decision was likely arbitrary and capricious. And the court said at page 46, the court thus concludes that Invenergy has a fair likelihood of success on the merits of its claim that the withdrawal was arbitrary and capricious. And the government just consistently ignores that there was that second basis for the TI. And the third factual reason that the motion to dismiss, the motion to dissolve has to fail is that the burden is on the government. The government has to show that the injunction should be dissolved and that doing so is equitable. By arguing only that the April notice cured the notice and comment deficiencies, the government hasn't done that. Indeed, its motion is remarkable for what it did not assert. The government did not argue in its motion that the April notice was not arbitrary and capricious. It did not assert that it had cured that additional APA deficiency that the court found merited the TI back in December. The government did not assert that plaintiffs no longer face irreparable harm if the withdrawal goes into effect. The government didn't even say that, much less show that. And the government did not assert that maintaining the injunction while the court evaluates the April notice on the merits would be inequitable. And, Your Honor, how could it? There is simply no harm to defendants from the TI continuing to apply for a few more months until this case is resolved. The government's motion should be assessed based on the grounds the government actually put forward for dissolving the TI in its motion. The government gave one and only one reason, that plaintiffs are no longer likely to succeed because USTR conducted a notice and comment process. But that reason necessarily fails to make the government's case because it completely ignores the other reason the court granted the TI, which was that it found that the withdrawal was likely arbitrary and capricious. And we think that the court's analysis of the motion to dissolve can really should end right there. But, you know, before I turn to responding to some of the government's responses and the court's question, I feel like you do also need to address the elephant in the room. And the elephant from our perspective is USDR's sudden production yesterday of two agency memos that neither plaintiffs nor the court has seen before, and which the government now essentially points to try to show that the April notice constitutes reasoned decision-making that fulfills the APA standard. And, Your Honor, there are so many problems with this development that it's really hard to know where to begin here. First, it was entirely improper and prejudicial for the government to produce those memos for the first time on the eve of this hearing. Withholding those memos until oral argument is far more prejudicial than submitting new arguments in a reply brief for the first time, which this court's case law is clear is prohibited. For example, in the new court case, which we cited in our brief, this court refused to consider new arguments that had not been first raised in a party's moving paper. And, Your Honor, for this reason alone, the court should not consider these memos in deciding the motion to dissolve. Second, an agency has to put its core reasoning in, or at least attach it to, its decision document, not hide it in a memo, an internal memo that's not mentioned in the public document or available for the public to review. Now, to be clear, it might be fine for an agency to put some of its reasoning or comment responses in a separate document where, for example, you have a really lengthy rule and a lot of responses or comments. I've certainly seen that done a fair amount. But then the agency needs to make that document part of its decision and publish it alongside the rule, and that's what agencies usually do. We have a real problem here where, you know, now the agency is pointing to these memos as supplying the basis and statement that was lacking in the April notice, but these are not memos that were published with its decision. And in a case called Baltimore and OCTR Company versus United States, and this is a Third Circuit case, the site is 583F 2nd 678. The Third Circuit explained that the rules and the statement of basis must be published close enough together in time so that there's no doubt that the statement accompanies rather than rationalizes the rules. And the Supreme Court also recently said something that I think is very on point on this issue, and that this was in the Department of Commerce, the New York decision, which you may remember, just the census issue. And when talking about the point of the, all these APA standards and what they require, the court said, the reasoned explanation requirement of administrative law is meant to ensure that agencies offer genuine justifications for important decisions, reasons that can be scrutinized by the courts and the interested public. Your Honor, if the public can't see the reasoning, the entire point of requiring reasoned decision-making is simply lost. And I also would point to the D.C. Circuit's decision, the Chamber of Commerce case, which has been cited in our brief. The site is 443F3890, where the D.C. Circuit reminded us that the most critical factual material that is used to support the agency's position must be made public. These considerations are no less relevant when an agency on remand considers whether to modify a rule. So we really think there's a problem here with the fact that the agency is now trying to point to these memos as supplying the reasoning that is missing in the initial notice. And in fact, it seems kind of like the agency is trying to sub in a new decision document for a deficient one to solve its APA problem. You know, I noticed that in its responses, and this is in response to question 9 at page 12, USTR made a really interesting statement. It said, the contested determination here consists of the light hydrant decision memo, and the findings and report would include the April withdrawal published in the Federal Register and the Garrett memo. Now, unpacking that, USTR now seems to be saying that it's one of the two new memos, the light hydrant memo, not the document published back in April, that is actually its determination, its decision document. But, Your Honor, a decision can't be sufficiently and clearly explained with the reasoning given under the State Farm standard when the government hasn't even published the decision document. And moreover, the government has to give 30 days from publishing its decision document before that decision can go into effect. And so it sounds like we should be coming from May 12th, yesterday, not April 16th, because the government's basically now saying that its decision document is one of these memos. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, though, you are, these late-breaking memos just don't change the fact that USTR did not actually argue in its motion to dissolve that the April notice remedies the arbitrary and capricious issue that was the second ground for the preliminary injunction. The government did not argue in its motion that the April notice was reasoned or supported. Because the government bears the burden of showing that dissolving the CI is warranted by changed circumstances and maintaining it was inequitable, the government's failure to make this argument is necessarily fatal to its motion. In other words, even if this court might possibly think that these two new memos satisfy the State Farm standard for rational decision-making, which, to be clear, we don't think they do, you know, and I'll just note that neither of them assesses one of the two core statutory considerations that the President pointed to in his proclamation, which was, you know, the question of whether the costs and benefits of the withdrawal outweigh the costs and benefits of the exclusion. They don't address that issue at all. But, you know, even setting that aside, even if the court thought that those memos might satisfy the State Farm standard, the PI should remain in place here because the government did not argue in its motion that the PI should be listed on that ground. So while we strenuously object to the government's failure to disclose these memos earlier, and frankly, Your Honor, I find it a little rich that Mr. Gurley is faulting us for not having addressed them in our responses yesterday when I think you saw them come across the docket about 3 hours before we filed those. You know, we don't think they should be considered here. We also don't think they change the calculus. Again, however, the court doesn't really even need to reach that issue. The government did not argue that plaintiffs are no longer likely to succeed on their arbitrary and capricious claim in its motion. It thus failed to meet its burden of showing that the dissolving the CI is justified and equitable. You know, Your Honor, if the government wanted to move again, once this motion is denied, because the grounds the government put forth in this motion don't justify dissolving the CI, if the government wanted to file a new motion and try to make the argument that it's now shown that its decision is not arbitrary and capricious, it could do that. And then we would have the normal 21 days to assess its new stated grounds for its new assertion that this is recent decision-making and respond to those in the normal course. But the key point here is that the government's motion to dissolve should be decided based on the grounds that the government asserted in that motion. Now, before I turn to responding to a couple of the government's statements and its responses, I did want to address the supplemental question that the court posed yesterday. And that question is, under the Trade Act, is USTR authorized to withdraw exclusion? Is it authorized under the presidential proclamation or under its previously promulgated procedures? Does the court need to resolve this question both before determining what action to take on the motion to dissolve? So to start at the top here, Your Honor, the 1974 Trade Act does not grant the president authority to increase or reimpose a safeguard measure once an exclusion has been granted. And this court pointed to the 2253-203, which certainly does have some broad language. But critically, in 2254B, that provision requires very specific procedures be undertaken before the president can modify a safeguard measure. And the legislative history that we pointed to in our brief says that modification does not mean increase. Now, those requirements, those specific procedural requirements of 204 are meaningless. If the president can, in fact, modify a safeguard measure any time, as the government now seems to argue. But even if it did, you know, the president delegated no such authority to USTR. Rather, he gave USTR narrow authority to prescribe procedures for exclusions within a specific time frame, which was 30 days. That makes it clear he was not giving USTR broader authority to take additional actions or create additional procedures to later modify or withdraw exclusions. And USTR's own exclusion procedures reflect that narrow delegation. There is no suggestion in them that USTR would or could revisit exclusions. And we have pointed to the relevant case law in this, Your Honor. You know, the general proposition is set forth most recently by the Supreme Court in the Mersharp case, where it said an agency literally has no power to act unless and until Congress can confer power upon it. And then we pointed to what I think is our home run case on this issue, the SAG Italia case, out of the Federal Circuit, where the Federal Circuit found that the Commerce Department could not conduct a duty absorption inquiry whenever it chose, because the statute provided for those inquiries only at certain specific intervals. And the court said, the fact that the agency is empowered to take action in certain limited situations does not mean that it enjoys such power in other instances. That statement equally applies here. You have a narrow delegation of authority that gave the agency power to act in certain specific ways at a certain time frame. And because it's narrow, one cannot assume that the agency has some broader authority to come back and revisit what it has previously done. Now, the government has relied on this proposition that an agency has inherent authority to reconsider its prior rules and actions. And, you know, Your Honor, that's true in a lot of cases, but not in a case where you have a narrow delegation like the one we have here in the FAG and the one in the FAG Italia case. These are fundamentally different delegations from the broad congressional delegations of general rulemaking authority that are at issue in, for example, the cases cited in the Garris memo and in the cases cited in Hanwha's responses as well. So we're just dealing with a fundamentally different type of delegation here. This is not, for example, a general delegation that says an agency has the authority to make all appropriate and necessary regulations, like it's true in a lot of statutory schemes. You don't have that here. And that's the premise on which that statement about inherent authority is usually made. Here we have a narrow delegation. We've got a huge amount of it. Now, the court does not need to reach this issue if it agrees that the government has not met its burden of showing that dissolution of the injunction would be inequitable. Because defendants only, and incorrectly, argued that by giving notice and comment, they had addressed the sole basis for the PI, which is wrong because the PI was premised on two different grounds. The government hasn't met its burden, and the court can just stop there. It doesn't need to address the authority issue in that instance. However, if the court thought that plaintiffs were no longer likely to succeed on the merits of their APA claim, then the court would need to assess whether they are nonetheless likely to succeed on this authority issue before the court could dissolve the injunction.
And there, you know, I would point the court to the Concilio de Salud case, which we think is very on point, where the First Circuit reversed, where the lower court had dissolved an injunction after the government took steps to put a process in place to address the claim that Medicare payments had been improperly withheld, but the government hadn't addressed the substantive questions of how those Medicare payments were supposed to be calculated. We're in a similar situation here. Yes, we do think that if the court isn't going to deny the motion to dissolve because the government hasn't met its burden, which is what we think should happen here, then it should assess whether we're also likely to succeed on the authority issue. Now, let me go back here and talk about a few of the government's responses. I'm going to try not to be too redundant here. First, a cross-cutting issue related to the government's reliance on the Garish memo throughout. You know, its responses to the court's questions number 4 and 9 through 11, which are questions that all went to whether the government has cured the ACA deficiencies from the October notice, those responses are predicated almost entirely on the content of the Garish memo, which, as I mentioned, we did not see until yesterday. Notably, however, the government doesn't even try to argue that the April notice itself constitutes reasoned decision-making or provides the necessary statement of basis and purpose. It points entirely to the Garish memo. And the question that poses to me is, how can the court find that defendants have sufficiently shown that their April withdrawal notice is not arbitrary and capricious when, first, they didn't even make that argument in their motion, and second, we're not even sure now what document we're supposed to be assessing, the April notice or one of those memos that defendants now say was, in fact, the determination. Again, Your Honor, it's their burden, and they've plainly failed to carry it here. Turning to some of the government's other responses, in response to question 1, the government asserts that the court may dissolve the TR without addressing the plaintiff's additional claims. But as I mentioned a minute ago, that's directly contrary to the First Circuit's conclusion in the Concilio de Salud case. In response to questions 2 and 3, I'll note that we agree with the defendants that the withdrawal of the exclusion can only go into effect after the court lifts the TR, and it has to be prospective. But we disagree with the government's assertion in response to question 3A, that plaintiffs must again demonstrate all four prongs of the TI standard in regard to the April notice. The government agrees that, as I said earlier, it's conceded that the current TI covers the April notice, and it's conceded that it has the burden to show that dissolution is warranted. Those concessions cannot be reconciled with the idea that the plaintiffs nonetheless have to reprove all the factors of the TI analysis in order for the TI to continue to restrict the government from enforcing or making effective a withdrawal of the exclusion. And I'll point the court to the ad hoc Trump case, which we said in our brief, where the court specifically noted that when looking at a motion to dissolve a TI, that motion should not be used as a vehicle for making the party that had obtained the TI reprove all four grounds for the TI. In response to question 4, the government again repeats its patently incorrect assertion that the April notice addressed the sole basis for the TI because it went through notice and comment. As I said earlier, that's just obviously at odds with the court's TI opinion. In regard to their response to question 5, we agree that the court absolutely has jurisdiction over the April notice if it grants the motions to supplement the complaint, but we think the court has jurisdiction over the April notice even without doing that. The April notice is essentially an action on remand, and the government admits in its January withdrawal procedures, in the April notice itself, and in its responses that it took that action directly in response to the court's TRI decision. The government can't avoid the court's jurisdiction simply because it did not ask the court for a remand before reconsidering the October notice as it should have. And in any event, based on the government's own statements in those regulatory documents, there's a clear connection between the April and October notices. In regard to the government's response on 5D, you know, the government again asserts that the plaintiff should remove for preliminary relief in this or some other suit. But that's simply not necessary, Your Honor, and we're not starting from a blank slate here. We've got a TI in place that the government agrees applies to its April decision, and it's their burden to show that dissolving the TI is warranted and equitable. But in any event, we do think it's entirely proper to view the April notice as an action on remand that remains under the court's jurisdiction and doesn't require revisiting the TI, particularly given that the agency reached the same conclusion in April that it reached last October. In other words, the scope and the substance of the decision are the same. And, you know, we would point the court to the Amy Court case here, which I think is really our home run case, particularly when discussing whether, you know, the TI should remain in place here. You know, the facts and holding of that case demonstrate that the TI need not be dissolved every time the government revisits its withdrawal. There, the TI has survived three different remands, and then it survived the government's change of heart, its complete reversal of position. So the idea that an injunction has to be dissolved every time the agency takes some further action to better support its decision, tweak its decision, or even change its decision, it just isn't consistent with this court's normal course of review. Plaintiffs agree with the government's statement in response to question 6 that there's no jurisdictional issue regarding the April withdrawal. We differ only in that we think that's true regardless of whether the court grants the motion to supplement the complaint, but in any event, the government does not oppose supplementation, and so at this point, I think it's clear that the court should go ahead and do that. In response to 7, the government asserted that the April withdrawal was not a remand proceeding. As I discussed before, we do think it should be viewed as a remand proceeding. There's a clear connection between the October and the April decisions. The government said several times that it was acting pursuant to this court's July order, so, you know, it is essentially a remand proceeding. And if it's not, the only reason is that the government failed to respect the court's jurisdiction and ask for a remand for reconsidering the withdrawal. The government should not be rewarded for failing to follow proper and normal procedures. Also, in responding to 7, the government asserts that this case is strikingly similar to the NRDC v. Ross case, and the government was talking about that a minute ago, where a TI was lifted. But the TI was lifted, Your Honor, I believe, pursuant to a settlement. And in fact, the facts leading to the consensual lifting of the TI were the opposite. The government had taken an action that did exactly what the plaintiffs had wanted it to do. And in fact, the government's new action, the embargo, gave them broader relief than the TI had. So that's obviously a very different situation than this one, where the government has only doubled down on the same unlawful and irrational action. And so the TI is still needed to protect the plaintiff's rights and interests until a final decision on the merits is reached. In response to question number 8, the government yet again repeats its incorrect assertion that the sole basis for the court's prior finding of likelihood of success on the merits was lack of notice and comment rulemaking. Again, the TI opinion itself at pages 44 to 46 quickly discloses of that. In response to question 8A, in that question, the court had asked the government what inequities continuation of the TI would cause them. Defendants had no answer to that. Instead, they argue the merits of their underlying determination that withdrawal is appropriate. But not having the core issue in the case resolved in their favor right now is not an inequity for purposes of the balance of harms on a CI. As I noted earlier, in response to questions 9 through 11, the government essentially concedes that the April notice by itself is not sufficiently explained reason or supported the survived APA review because it relies entirely on the new matter. In responding to 9B, the government defends its reliance on the April notice on the March ICC report. But even if we set aside the question of whether that report substantively supports the government's conclusions, there's two big problems with that. First, contrary to the government's statement, there is a requirement that decision makers make their decision based on the material provided by and available to commenters. And that, again, comes from the Chamber of Commerce case, where the D.C. Circuit said the most critical factual material used to support the agency's position must be made public and subjected to informed comment. But perhaps more importantly, USCIS response on this issue is also at odds with the Garris memo, which it now hinges so much of its arguments on. And in that memo on page 16, the writer disclaims reliance on the March ICC report and says, "We base the recommendation set out above exclusively on the information available at the close of the comment period." So in other words, you know, if that memo is now reading the decision document, that memo itself recognizes that the March ICC report can't be the support for the decision. Rather, the support has to come out of the comments and what was available to commenters to see.
And finally, in response to question 12, the government concedes that the plaintiff must have the opportunity to address the lawfulness of the vehicle notice in Maryland 3 days, and that can happen in this case. And we totally agree there. But the government closes out its response to 12 by repeating a critical and fatal mistake. It references the overarching authority issue, but it again, yet again, ignores the arbitrary and capricious issue and the fact that the court granted the TI based on it. The government's failure to address both bases for the TI is fatal to its motion to dissolve. And before I close briefly, I want to address the two things Mr. Gurley has said. At some point he said, what more can the government do than what is done here? Well, I have an answer for that, Your Honor, and that is to follow normal procedures. And this time, sure, the government went back and it did some simulcum of notice and comment. We do think that it was too short. We do think it's pretty clear that the government was rushing to a predetermined conclusion. But then, you know, what the government's done recently here is, yet again, not following normal procedures. It publishes the date on notice. It's very fair. Doesn't lay out its reasoning. Doesn't talk through the comments at all. And then suddenly, yesterday, it produces a more reasoned analysis and says, oh, wait, this is our decision. So again, all we're asking is for the government to follow normal procedures. And also, Mr. Gurley asserted that plaintiffs will be able to get their money back. And this goes back to the irreparable harm issue, which, as I said earlier, is not something we need to be recruiting here. But that is just wrong. As this court found in its PI opinion, the harm here wasn't just procedural, it was also reputational and economic. And the economic harm is irreparable because it comes from lost contracts and projects that will never be completed if this tariff goes into place. So, in closing, Your Honor, I just want to return to the point that the government hasn't met its burden of showing that it's appropriate to dissolve the TI, both because it refuses to acknowledge the court's second round for finding plaintiffs likely to succeed, and also because it didn't show that it would be inequitable to maintain the TI for the next 2 months while this case is decided on merit. Conversely, it would not be equitable to lift the TI on the basis of arguments the government didn't even make in its motion, or on the basis of documents that the agency provided to the court and asked for the first time only yesterday. Thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions that the court has.
Thank you, Ms. Berman. I have a couple of questions. In its motion to dissolve, the government sets forth the findings provided in the determinations by the USTR in its publication of April 14th. And so why does that go to the your point that the government has not addressed the arbitrary and capricious component and basis of the TI?
Sure, Your Honor. So, well, as we tried to explain in our brief, the problem with that list of nine findings is that they are entirely conclusory. There's no reasoning or explanation of how the government got to those conclusions, which is pretty critical, we think. And also, in the April notice, there's no discussion of where the comments came in on all of those issues. There's no responses to the comments. There isn't even an acknowledgement of the comments. So if you look at the April notice, you just think that it's far too bare to satisfy the state harm standard, which requires the government to set out, it has to explain how it was able to make its finding, it has to show the relevant data and explain the basis for its decision, as the D.C. Circuit explained in the Allied Signal case. It has to articulate a satisfactory explanation for its actions, including a rational connection between the facts found and the choice made. And that connection between the fact and the choice is entirely missing from the April notice.
And what is your response to the argument made by counsel that if the court were to grant the motion to supplement the complaint, which would quite clearly bring in the related issues relating to the April withdrawal, plaintiff intervener would have the opportunity to file if they deemed it necessary, another motion for a preliminary injunction. And the concerns that you've presented regarding the April withdrawal could be fleshed out.
Sure, Your Honor. So we simply don't think that's necessary or appropriate here. We have all been proceeding based on the government's statement back in January when it published the withdrawal procedures, and then again in the April notice, that the government views the current TI as preventing it from entering into force any withdrawal of the exclusion, including pursuant to its latest decision document, the April notice. We've all been, proceeding on that basis. So with that being the fact, the burden is then on the government to justify dissolving the PI. And, as I pointed a minute ago to the ad hoc shrimp case where the court made a clear statement that when you're moving to dissolve a PI, the other party doesn't have to re-argue all of the grounds for the PI in the first place. That's just not appropriate. And this court said something similar in the SKF case when it was talking about how long its initial preliminary injunction should remain in place. It said, the interests of judicial economy weigh against requiring the issuance of a second injunction predicated on the same grounds as the first. No meritorious reason has been put forth by the government for judicial creation of an additional procedural burden. That applies equally here, Your Honor. If the government thinks that it has solved both of the problems that this court found in its PI opinion as giving rise to a likelihood of success for plaintiffs, that it needs to move to dissolve the PI, which it agrees covers the initial notice on that basis.
Thank you, Ms. Berman. Mr. Knightley?
Thank you, Your Honor. Matt Knightley for SCIA. I thought Ms. Berman did an excellent job in covering the primary points. I don't even know if I need to take all the time that's remaining for us, but our goal has been for her to basically cover the government's answers to your questions and for me to cover Hanlo's answers. And so I'll proceed to do that, but by definition there's going to be a little bit of redundancy, for which I apologize, but I'll try to focus on some new points. Let me just start right off the bat with, instead of wasting time with any kind of opening, with jumping into to their answers to questions. In question one, Hanlo, like DOJ, claims that the PI can be dissolved without addressing plaintiff's other claims, but as Ms. Berman has explained and as we addressed in our answer to the same question, they're simply wrong, and the Consilio case, we think, is directly on point in that regard. Hanlo, again, like DOJ, also claims that the procedural deficiencies have been cured, but that's not at all the case. As the court knows, the procedural deficiencies went far beyond mere notice and comment. The October notice was also found to lack reasoned decision-making, and was found that, therefore, claims were therefore likely to be able to prove that the decision was arbitrary and capricious. This was not fixed in the April notice. Furthermore, the April notice specifically referenced the history of the October notice and therefore suggested in discussing that history, the USCR was taking actions in response to the court's preliminary injunction in an effort to fix the problems of the October notice. DOJ confirmed as much in the motion to dissolve. Because the decision remains is arbitrary and capricious, because it does not even address the comments received, it remains in violation of the APA. The claims are the same as what we originally complained about with respect to October notice, as reflected in our supplemental complaints, which no one has objected to. USCR and Hanlo both admit that the April notice cannot go into effect while the PI is in place. If this is the case, then the actions are not so separate as the defendants claim. And to dissolve the PI and require plaintiffs to bring a new case and file a new PI motion would be the height of judicial inefficiency and would allow the government to hide behind a technicality that it was not subject to a remand, but voluntarily started a new proceeding, even though that proceeding by their own admission, only occurred because of this court's preliminary injunction. The court should not tolerate this gamesmanship. And the court should also not tolerate the gamesmanship evidenced by what happened yesterday. PAMA claims in their answer to your question one that the April notice, quote, entailed a robust analysis of the comments filed. You will search in vain, Your Honor, for any such analysis in the April notice. We can only surmise that PAMA is referring to the memos DOJ made available to the court and the parties just yesterday. These cannot be used at such a late date to cure the arbitrary and capricious nature of the April notice. The parties, the commenters, and the public were entitled to an explanation of the USTR's decision at the time it was made. At the very least, one would have expected DOJ to include these memos with their motion to dissolve. But they waited until the day before oral argument to string these on us? Given that we've had but one day to digest these documents, it would be inappropriate for the court to consider these documents in ruling on defendant's motion to dissolve. Indeed, these documents have nothing to do with the arguments made in the motion to dissolve, as that motion only addressed notice and comment, and not arbitrary and capricious decision-making. We suggest instead that the court simply deny the motion to dissolve rather than allow them to get away with this gamesmanship. One final point on Hanma's answer to the court's question one. They claim that plaintiffs bear the burden to prove we are entitled to a PI with respect to the April notice. We disagree on multiple fronts. We are here today to discuss the defendant's motion to dissolve the PI. By USTR's own admission, the PI covers the April notice. It was therefore up to defendants to prove that the April notice cured all the deficiencies of the October notice. They have not done so, as they don't even address in their motion the arbitrary and capricious claims. Meanwhile, the authority claims have not been fully briefed and resolved by the court. Defendants, frankly, don't even make it to first base in meeting their burden to justify dissolving the PI. There's a lot there in their answer to question one, so I suspect my reactions to their other questions are going to be perhaps a little bit redundant, but I'll cruise through them quickly. Their answer to question four, because they skipped some of the questions, they largely restate what they had said in question one, that is, that the procedural flaws are fixed because USTR conducted notice and comment. Again, the problems were far greater than just notice and comment. It's not fixed, and it's not even addressed in their motion. With regard to question five, here, Hanla continues to make the argument that the April notice is a separate agency action. The April notice specifically references the October notice in the court's PI, and DOJ has said the April notice was in response to the court's PI, and which is a ruling with regard to the October notice. We're very happy that USTR has abandoned the October notice, but abandonment of that decision alone cannot allow USTR to escape the court's oversight, which USTR admits the court still retains to ensure that the April notice, in fact, cures the defects of the October notice. We have shown how that did not happen and how DOJ's motion did not even try to argue that it did, as it claimed that having conducted notice and comment was enough. It's not enough, as the court's PI opinion makes clear. And let me point out something that we explained in our answers to the questions. The benefits to the public of notice and comment are not achieved by merely going through the motions. Those benefits are purely ephemeral if they are not accompanied by reasoned decision-making. The April notice shows no such reasoning, and the memos issued only yesterday cannot overcome this hurdle. At the very least, Your Honor, we would suggest, and as Ms. Vernon alluded to, we would suggest that the 30 days required by the APA should run from yesterday, at the very least, and that the defendants should be required to file a new motion to dissolve, and that we be given 21 days to address that new motion now that we all have these memos that supposedly are the basis for the decision. Having us try to react to that in a single day before this oral argument is almost laughable. Question six. There's nothing really new here in Honolulu's answer. It's just more of the same. Clearly, the court maintains jurisdiction over the April notice, or else UFPR would not have said in that notice that it would await the court's ruling on the PI before the withdrawal would become effective. Honolulu claims there's no pending challenge to the April notice, but this is not true, as the court has our supplemental complaints in which we explain that the same problems that infected the October notice also infect the April notice. Question seven. Honolulu's answer here is just as tortured as the government's. They continue to fall back on the notion that this was not a remand, but they admit to being instructed by this court to redo its consideration of the withdrawal consistent with the APA, and to ask the court to dissolve the PI after complying. Whether this is a remand by name is not relevant. What matters is that the action they took is exactly the same. And while notice and comment happened, reasoned decision-making did not, and therefore the cure has yet to occur. That there was no official remand is irrelevant. Now, question eight, claims that Mir, again, this is getting to be a little bit redundant. Hama claims that mere abandonment of the October notice is sufficient reason to dissolve the PI. But as the court's question makes clear, this ignores the fact that the court retains jurisdiction and that the April notice does nothing to cure the arbitrary and capricious nature of the withdrawal. Just saying over and over again that the April notice is a separate action does not cure this defect. And let me also make the point about the claim of mootness. Mootness cannot be applicable here when the agency's decision in April was exactly the same as the decision in October. The purpose of an injunction is to prevent future violations. There's this notion of no likelihood of recurrence. Well, the same thing recurred. How could the PI suddenly be moot simply because they have abandoned the October decision and replaced it with the exact same decision in April, yet a decision that, on its face, in the FR, isn't any different from what happened in October? Answer to question 8A. Hama asked the court to consider the impact on them in weighing the equities here, but this is nothing different from what Hama faced last year when this court issued the PI. Plaintiffs should not bear the brunt of USTR's repeated failures to comply with the law merely because another private party wishes for an alternative conclusion. The issue here is compliance with the APA. Plaintiffs continue to face irreparable harm as a result of USTR's continued violations of the APA. The equities, therefore, in this context, continue to rest with the plaintiffs. Question 9. Hama argues here that the case law supports the notion that an agency's decision need not contain ideal clarity as long as the agency's path can be reasonably discerned. Despite USTR's finding, the April notice that the exclusion would undermine the objective of the safeguard measure and therefore should be withdrawn. But this, again, is no different from what USTR had concluded in October, which was insufficient in the eyes of this court. While we can all agree that the court's job is not to substitute its judgment for the agency's, this does not absolve the agency from explaining the rationale in light of the comments received, which the April notice did not do. Because of the obvious weaknesses in this argument, Hama relies on the Garris memo that the court and the plaintiff only saw for the first time yesterday. Again, clearly, this cannot support a motion to dissolve in which the government didn't even alert the court or plaintiffs to their existence. In their answer to question 9B, HAMA defends U.S. shares reliance on the March 2020 ITC report and claims the plaintiffs, including SIA, participated in that proceeding. Let me be clear about this point. That proceeding concerned what impact increasing the quota for imports of cells, sometimes referred to as the cell exclusion, would have on the domestic industry. HAMA supported the increase in that cell quota so that they could get duty-free imports of cells. SIA's involvement in that proceeding was limited to supporting Hanwha and other domestic producers seeking to ease restrictions on imports of cells. The notion that SIA's involvement in that proceeding somehow undermines our criticism of U.S. shares' reliance on it in this case is specious. Any reference to bifacial panels in that report was incidental to the question at hand, that is, whether restrictions on cells should be loosened. The ITC's mention of the fact that demand for bifacial panels is expected to increase is hardly newsworthy in any finding as to the effect of bifacial panels on module and cell prices entirely speculative, particularly when taking into consideration CIA's proposed modification to the exclusion, which the ITC did not address in its report, and which the SCR did not address in the April notice. Let me also I don't know how much time I have, only a couple of minutes, I think. Mr. Gold, can you tell me if you can use the time check?
Mr. Gold?
I'm sorry, I had my mute on. 6 minutes.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you. I'm just trying to make sure, again, that I don't, address. So, This is probably as good a time as any for me to mention something that Mr. Gurley keeps on suggesting, and it just can't keep on going unaddressed. He has said that a prior oral argument in front of Your Honor, and again today, he has used the term fraud with respect to what was requested by those who sought the exclusion in the first place. And this is so inflammatory, I can't let go again. We admit that bifacial panels became more compelling to the market between March 2018, when the exclusions were requested, and June 2019, when the exclusion was granted. But that certainly does not suggest that in March 2018, we could be so prescient to know that bifacial panels were going to be as compelling to the market as they are today, or as they are early, or as they were even in June 2019. The notion that the parties who requested the exclusion had somehow committed fraud when they asked for the exclusion and claimed it was a niche product is outrageous. In June 2019, notwithstanding the passage of over a year since the exclusion was requested, USGR decided that granting that exclusion would not undermine the utility of the safeguard measure. And yet four months later, they could do a complete flip-flop? They made a decision that didn't undermine it in June. How they could conclude with hardly any difference in facts between June and October that suddenly it did undermine it is unclear to us, completely unclear to us. But clearly, given those facts that I've just shared with you, there is no fraud involved whatsoever. And for Mr. Gurley to keep referencing this, I think, is unconscionable. Let me address a couple of their other answers. Respect to question 9C, HAMA points to USGR's January notice inviting comments, which asked in part for information about how the exclusion might be modified. Despite significant commentary on that point, particularly from SIA, by the way, there was no analysis of it. Instead, only a conclusory statement that read almost exactly like the October notice read, that the bifacial exclusion is undermining the safeguard measure. HAMA goes on to say that agencies have inherent authority to change their decisions, but that does not absolve the agency from engaging in reasoned decision-making, which the April notice on its face shows did not occur. And, as Ms. Berman has pointed out, They do not have, in this instance, inherent authority where the delegation of authority was as extremely limited as it was here, and where the statute, as we, as Ms. Berman has also discussed, is clear of cabining the extent to which modifications can be made under Section 204. Let me end just one last comment on with regard to question 11. The issue that Hahn or like the government failed to address here is the fact that USCR gave no consideration of the issue of utility scale development, which was at the heart of the comments submitted by CF and other supporters of the exclusion. Substitutability as between monofacial and bifacial panels in the utility scale sector only matters if the domestic industry is actually serving that segment of the market. And we demonstrated woefully limited capacity among domestic producers to supply this segment. This is why we proposed to modify the exclusion, to limit it to utility scale modules, as was originally requested. But our comments were entirely ignored in the April notice. We are not asking that the court supplant USCR's substantive decision-making power here, but to ensure that the procedural protections provided by the APA are honored. Here, USCR requested comments on possible modifications to the exclusion. We provided those comments, supported by economic analysis, yet those comments were completely ignored in the April notice. This does not meet the reasoned decision-making requirements of the APA. And with that, Your Honor, I think we are done, or if we have a minute or two, I'll turn it back to Ms. Berman if she has anything to add.
Thank you, Mr. Knightley.
Ms. Berman, if you don't have anything to add, I think, Your Honor, we're...
There's just 1 minute left.
Sure, Your Honor. I'll take the opportunity just to make two final points. We were talking a bit about the authority issue earlier. And, you know, one thing that I wanted to make clear as well is that, you know, there's the question of does the President have authority under the statute, and then does USCR have authority under the delegation? And an important part of that second question is, you know, even if USCR does have authority generally, USCR doesn't have authority to ignore one of the two statutory factors that the President himself identified as critical to determining whether a safeguard measure should be, in fact, be imposed, and that is the costs and benefits of withdrawal versus exclusion. And then the other point I just wanted to follow up on, because I'm thinking maybe I didn't fully address your first question to me at the end, when you asked about the findings, the USCR's 9 findings. You know, I think the key point there is that USCR didn't argue in its motion that those 9 findings clear the arbitrary and capricious hurdle. They don't actually make that argument, and they don't make that argument in their responses. They instead point to the memos that they produced yesterday. So again, you know, at the end of the day, I think we just need to go back to the fact that, you know, the government has a burden here, and it didn't make the argument that it has in fact cleared the arbitrary and capricious hurdle. And that's it for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Berman.
Your Honor, this is John Gurley. Could you give me 15 seconds just to address Mr. Mikesy's comments on fraud?
I will give you 15 seconds.
I never said that they committed fraud. I said about it in the context of why shouldn't the USCR be able to reverse a decision if there had been fraud committed on USCR, if there had been mistakes, if there had been typos, etc. I never accused them of fraud. On the other hand, they accused the USCR of conducting a sham proceeding. So there you go.
Thank you, Mr. Gurley. Before we go, I would like to follow up with Mr. Cicini. A couple of matters.
Yes, Your Honor.
First matter regards the April 10th, 2020, what's referred to as the Garish Memorandum, which was provided to the court and to the parties yesterday. You've heard counsel express, you know, deep concern that but that was not made available prior to yesterday. I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that.
Well, yes, Your Honor, thank you. There's two reasons. First, although it wasn't published in the Federal Register, it's part of the administrative record under the court's rules, and we're under no obligation to publish those memoranda until we answer the complaint and file the administrative record under Rule 73.3. And importantly, we provided the Garish memo in direct response to the court's questions. The court asked in question 9, among other things, has USPR displayed awareness that it is changing position and shown that there are good reasons for a new policy? Question 9C. And the FR notice didn't go into detail on that, but the Garish memo did, where it cited State Farm and discussed in detail the fact that, yes, the USPR was changing position from the exclusion to withdrawing the exclusion. And that was the evidence that USPR displayed awareness. Second, I want to, or actually, one more point I'd like to make before closing is that the plaintiff spent a lot of time contending that the government never addressed the arbitrary and capricious arguments. And if you look at pages 7 and 8 of our motion to dissolve the PI, the last partial paragraph says, further, the determination is an entirely new action that is entitled to a presumption of regularity and has not yet been challenged. And then we say, before concluding that the determination is unlikely to be sustained, the court must consider whether the decision was based on a consideration of the relevant factors and whether there's been a clear error of judgment. And then we cite cases for, among other things, presumption of correctness. Absent such a conclusion, the injunction is left without its primary support. So we squarely address that issue. And the reason we didn't need to affirmatively defend the April withdrawal, even though it's incredibly defensible, the reason we didn't was because it's rendered moot the October withdrawal, and the court noted deficiencies in the October withdrawal, which are absent from the April withdrawal. And finally, I just want to close with noting that, unlike some sort of the sham proceeding that was alleged by some parties, when the court issued its decision, USPR took that decision to heart and followed the outline provided by the court in its decision in order to provide a full and fair hearing for all of the parties. It reached its analysis based on actual hard data. Now, a number of these conclusions that USPR reached were identical to conclusions reached later by the entirely independent International Trade Commission issuing a unanimous report. So we can't really lose sight of the main point here, which is USPR conducted a full and fair proceeding in accordance with the manner that the court had directed in its PI decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Steeney. I want to thank counsel for your arguments. I will give counsel the opportunity to file a supplemental submission in response to what you've heard during the course of the arguments today. And such a submission should not exceed 10 double-spaced pages. And it will be due no later than this Friday. May 15th at 5 p.m. And I would ask that where necessary, both published and confidential versions be filed.
Sure.
So are there any further questions of the court at this point?
Nothing more for the government. Thank you.
Thank you. Plaintiffs,
not from here, Your Honor. Thank you.
No, I don't think we have any further. Thank you, Your Honor.
Not from
Mr. Gurley?
Yeah,
right here. Again, I want to thank counsel for your arguments and also for your patience during the our own 18-minute chat. We will... We will be adjourned, and be safe and be well. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.